Stay tuned for the Culture Pot, the show that celebrates the music, the culture and the people of the world. Back to the Culture Pot with Martin Morrison, or Dad, every Sunday from 3 to 5 on Radio Sangam.
Hello, namaste, sat sri akal, and salamu alaikum. This is Martin on the Culture Pot on Radio Sangam on 107.9 FM. And I love that song, but you know, it didn't give me any warning before the voice came in. It was like, you know, it gives you a couple of bars and that's it. I've got to be there to beat into it. So, as you know, I like to bring guests to the table who have got real life experience to share. And the guy that I'm going to introduce you to today, I met him at the Professional Speaking Association that I've recently joined, because it's full of the sort of people I think you'd like to meet. He was recovering, actually, from a triple bypass operation, so we'll get to that. He's a public speaker, trainer and MC, and he's known as Phil the Funnel. His actual name's Phil Heath. But Phil the Funnel is here with me today, and he's got a stack of letters after his name as well, which I'm going to ask him to tell you about. So, Phil, thanks very much for coming in today.
My pleasure, Martin. Thanks for having me.
I must say, it's the third time I've seen you now, and you've got more colour in your cheeks every time I see you.
I'm feeling much better, yes, thank you.
You did look like death warmed up the first time I met you, but I wasn't going to say that to you, you know. So tell me, you were saying to me about what you're doing, what your qualifications are, and the letters after your name. Do you want to just tell them what they are?
Yeah, I think a lot of it's just pretentious, really. The Fellowship of the Institute of Sales and Marketing Management is just a title I got. I inherited that some years ago. I've been a salesman all my life.
Yeah.
And I love selling and I love sales.
It's a beautiful art.
It's a fantastic art. We don't appreciate sales in this country. So I'm very proud to be a salesman. And the other three letters after my name, DTM, is Distinguished Toastmasters from Toastmasters International. I can talk about that later on.
Weird, you gave me a card and the letters aren't on here. It must have been your LinkedIn profile that I've seen it, yeah. And I'll tell you what, because we've only got a few seconds before we go to the adverts, just the way the cookie's crumbling today. It's funny you said that about sales, because I'm giving a talk at a school in Leeds tomorrow about employability, and they'll be expecting me to stand up and talk about look them in the eye and shake hands and all this. But I'm going to be giving the sell this pen story. And I'm going to be showing them how a 30 pence biro becomes much more valuable if I got it from Stormzy the night before at, you know, Glastonbury, and saying how sales is pivotal to every act of influence and persuasion. But for now, we've got to go to the ads. We'll be right back. I wouldn't catch a falling star myself, Phil. I'd just like to watch them. You know, I was about 21 or 22 before I ever saw anything that, you know, what they call a shooting star. I'd heard of them. And I remember I was smashed out of my head living down in a place called Staines in Middlesex. And, you know, it was a long way to go at 18. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and the people I was with, we were all partying. I've all decided they're going to go out and lie on the grass, as you do when you're young and you don't care about stuff, staring at the sky. And this star suddenly wobbled and apparently went across the universe. I was mind blown. But, you know, I don't know if that's the same for everybody else. Anyway, there you go. I thought I'd say something to link up with the song that was playing. So, Phil, what particularly appealed to me to bring you on the show was the fact that you've been all around the world talking about sales and giving courses. And so you've got quite a, well, you're bound to have quite an interesting perspective on culture, you know, because I know people who get all neurotic about how you hold your knife and fork in a restaurant. And I'm always sitting there thinking, that's very, very sad and closed-minded for you to be like that. You know, there's many more things we can get passionate about. So tell us how it all began for you. You know, where you grew up, what you were thinking as a kid, what you aspired to do. Were you always a little bit of a chatterbox or a bit of a salesman?
No, I've always been fairly shy, and a lot of that developed through my later life when I became even more shy. I couldn't walk into a room full of people. Even getting into a lift was quite difficult for me. I suffer from depression, and I think that's important to help others. That depression is quite a difficult subject to talk about. People don't speak about it. There's been a lot in the press recently and on the news, but depression is a difficult subject, and it's always something that you hide. You know, you don't tell people very often that, oh, I'm a depressive, I'm a manic depressive. So you try and keep that under.
Are you bipolar?
I'm not sure, probably. I've never been diagnosed bipolar, but I've certainly been diagnosed for depression.
Okay.
And I was on tablets at one time. So it's quite a difficult period of my life that I went through. But when I was younger, I didn't have a care in the world, really. I grew up on a council estate in Seacroft in Leeds. I loved my life. I just went out and played. But I was probably very shy then. I wasn't the first to jump in front and volunteer for anything, and I certainly didn't speak out. So I probably had a bit of a quiet nature.
Yeah, you still do, I think. Even though you're a speaker, I know you're a speaker. I don't know how to put it, not a reservedness, but a bit of a humility about you, quite a humbleness is what's always come across whenever I've met you. So when you were growing up in Seacroft, what did you think you were going to be? I know a lot of kids talk about being soldiers, don't they? You know? What?
Well, I always wanted to be a pilot in the RAF, and that was something that really fascinated me. I'd love to be able to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got to wanting to join the RAF, I had a wonky eye, so it was a case of I couldn't do that, and I didn't want to join anything else or do anything else, so I gave that up as a bad job, really. So the RAF bypassed me, I bypassed them. But it was always a passion, something that I really wanted to do. But in sales, I just sort of grew into sales, really. I joined when I was 16, I went to work at a local shop in Leeds, in the centre of Leeds, and I sold TVs, hi-fis and radios, and it was a great life, just really helping people buy the product that they wanted to buy.
What was it you were selling?
Hi-fis, TVs,
okay.
So just little radios as well, the Roberts radio. I shouldn't mention that, should I? But
I do it all the time. It's terrible, honestly, off-coming, and it'll kill me one day. What at that time were you good at selling, would you say?
I've probably never been good at selling, but I like people, and I think that's the main thing. So I've always believed that in sales, people buy from people, not me, and I don't really sell a product, I sell me, and if people want to buy it, then that's how I've always approached sales. If they want to buy it, then that's fine. If they don't, I'm quite happy for them to walk away. So it's never been a pressure sale.
So you're a facilitator.
That's really where I succeed, yeah, in that people buy from me rather than me forcing them on a product. But I think everybody sells. I've got my grandchildren now, and they sell to me all the time. They just stand there and say no, or say yes, or I want, and it's amazing how very quickly you give in. So they're probably the best salespeople in the world, my grandkids.
Well, I've got an 11-year-old son, and the tactic that he uses reminds me of what hackers use when they ram a computer with passwords until they get in, really. He just relentlessly, until I give in. That's what kids do, isn't it?
They do.
I think I get an easier time from Leon than I gave my parents, though, to be honest with you, especially my mum. So, you know, you left school at 16, did you?
No, I left at 18, but I sort of failed from 16 onwards. I rejoined school. Part of my, I suppose, difficult in growing up in childhood was when I was 13, my elder sister had a road traffic accident, so she's severely disabled right now, so I've looked after her for ever since she was 16. She's 67 now, so it's been quite a long time. But when she was 16, I had to look after my younger sister. She was in a coma for 6 months, and I had to look after my sister, look after my mum and dad. So I really grew up when I was around about 12, 13, and school, I wasn't interested. So although I stayed on at school at 16, I would have probably been better leaving than getting a job. I stayed on and didn't do very well. But
even while all that was going on, would you still describe yourself as a happy-go-lucky kid at that time?
Probably, yes. It was always a difficult time in our lives as a family, but we grew stronger together. But still, I was a little bit shy and reserved at that time. And then I left school at 18. My passion and my problem, my one regret in life was that I applied to be a Butlins Redcoat. I got the job and I turned it down because my dad said, oh, you need a career for life, and joined the bank. So that's what I did. I joined a major bank in the UK, and I regret that. I should have gone into Butlins and been a Redcoat. That would have been me.
But you still ended up being a speaker.
I did. At school as well, I was an actor. I used to act. But I think a lot of it in acting and in speaking, especially in acting, you're speaking somebody else's words and not your own. So it took me a long time to find my own voice. And I think finding that voice has taken a number of years. And it's probably only over the last 10, 12 years that I've really come to the fore in speaking. But prior to that, I found it very difficult to speak in public.
Well, Richard McCann always turns around and says that that people actually prefer death. It's one of the biggest fears is speaking in public. I was thinking back to my childhood, actually, only recently. As a 10-year-old, I got on the stage in Butlins, and I had a guitar and I was singing "Oh Lord My God" when I an awesome wonder, which it's a Christian hymn, but Elvis Presley had sung it as well, and I really liked it. And I practiced it and practiced it, felt as though I was pretty good. Got there on the stage, which of course felt like the Albert Hall for me as a 10-year-old. Looking at all these people, get halfway through, suddenly realised I've forgotten my words. Burst out crying, I forgot my words, came off the stage, and they talked me round to going back on. And I can honestly say to you that until very recently, I always wrote that off as a complete failure. Instead of seeing what I did, I'd always written it off as being terrible, until my brother, who's older than me, he's 55, 56, said to me, he was talking to me only like literally a month ago about it, and he said that day he was really proud of me because he was sat in the audience and everyone was going, isn't he amazing? He's got back on stage. You know, thinking back, it was an achievement because a lot of people, even teachers, are frightened of doing assemblies, aren't they?
They are. A lot of people are afraid of standing in front of an audience. I think a lot of the fear is in our own minds, but it's always that trying to get that across to people that, in actual fact, if it's in your own mind, the people in the audience don't realise that you are suffering from nerves and that you are fearful. They don't realise that. They just want you to be a good speaker, and they want to listen to you. So it's always an interesting concept that we're always scared to death.
Yeah, because we see a group, but it's not a collective. It's lots of individual minds who are each looking at you and hoping that you won't let them down. It's the same for comedians, isn't it?
It is.
But one thing that I'm trying to join up, square the circle, anyway, is you said to me that you were quite a shy kid, but at the same time you were, you know, you wanted to be in the RAF and fly planes, so you must have liked adrenaline, I'm guessing.
Yep.
And you wanted to be a Redcoat. So was that because you just wanted the challenge? Were you not afraid of getting that stage?
I suppose in those earlier days, I was not afraid of anything, really. I just wanted to do something and be in front of people. And I think I would have, because I've grown up to be a good facilitator. I help people. And I think that Butlins would have been a good place to learn that, but I didn't go into that, and then felt a little bit cheated, really, and I felt I should have done that, and just to have that's probably my only regret in life. But after that, I went through a whole career path in the financial services. I worked in every part of financial services, and then got to the end of that and thought I got depressed, and it wasn't for me. Bit of a nightmare at that time.
Were you even selling when you were doing financial services?
Yeah, I sold life pensions, I sold investments, and it just got really got on top of me. And I lost everything at that point. I lost my house. I was bankrupt. So things really took a bad turn, and that's when I suffered from a major part of depression.
Why was that then? I mean, were you not succeeding? Was it soul destroying? Give us the juice.
It's a mixture, really. It is soul destroying. It's a cold call. I wasn't doing the cold calling as I should, probably because I was afraid of picking up the phone. And at that time, I then had three children. You've got a lot of pressure on you then, having to bring in the money to support the children and the family. And I just felt it was really hard, really difficult, and my brain just switched off from the whole industry, and I just got absolutely fed up, but suffered from depression. I ended up on tablets, and then when I was made bankrupt, I came out of the bankruptcy court, I came home and sat on the steps, and I just I was literally in that moment. I was very close to thinking I could end this, because it was, I had a life assurance policy that they would have all benefited from, and I just felt that this is really, I didn't want to be there, but I didn't know what else to do. I funnily enough, I've still got the rope that I was considering using on that particular day, and it's just a reminder of that bad time that I was in. It was a pretty bad time in my period of depression. I was on tablets, and I suffered pretty badly at that.
How old were you then?
I was probably in my early 40s at that time, so it was as late as that.
Right.
So it's been...
So how many years were you in finance?
I was in finance for 20 years, so...
So that's Maynard's by Askamandir that I'm interrupting. You're listening to Martin Morrison on the Culture Pot on Radio Sangam on 107.9 FM. Don't forget, if you want to text us or ask any questions of my guest today, you can do so on 07444 202155. You know, feel free, don't ring in, but do text in or send us a WhatsApp. So Phil, thanks again for coming on the show.
It's all right.
I was just wondering what it was that made you were obviously very happy with the sales that you were doing face to face with like TV and hi-fi equipment, and I know because I used to sell financial services over the phone. It's a completely different kettle of fish. What made you take that jump in the first place?
In the first place, I think it was the money. It was always an interesting aspect. I was in finance selling selling hire purchase for cars and lorries and vans, and I was getting paid a salary, but I financed a number of cars for a famous life assurance company, and everybody was saying, you ought to come and sell for us. And the attraction of the money was great. So I then went self-employed. I probably was better than most at it. The carnage, we had people leaving after 6 months, 8 months, 12 months. The turnover was very high. But I stayed in the industry for 8 years. But then the rules and regulations changed. It took the fun out of selling, and I just felt really...
Are we talking about the 90s here?
Yeah, that's sort of that time.
Yeah. I'll turn that off, carry on, sorry.
That's all right. So it was quite a difficult time, but I just got so... totally depressed with the industry, depressed with my life, and it was just a bad time. So I just thought I really wanted to do something. So, like I say, I lost everything. We moved house, but my main thing is I stayed together with my wife, got three children, and I just stayed with them. I was unemployed for 2 years, so I've sort of been through the whole wreck and ruin. But we stayed together. We've been together 42 years this year, so it's
wow.
Not too bad. So
that's impressive. Right. I don't think I've managed to beat 5 years in any of my numerous relationships. Even my current partner, I don't know how she suffers me really. Another thing I'm curious about is that I know that while you were doing the financial services, that's when you moved into training and you're training other people. Surely you were finding that rewarding?
I did, but I didn't get the opportunity to really to do it for myself, although I trained people and I was successful at that. And there are still people in the life assurance industry that are still there from that I trained, so I know I was obviously pretty good at it. But I just felt unfulfilled in my own life, really. I just didn't know where I was going, lost my direction, and it was just that, didn't know where to go. And I say, suffering from depression, it was quite a difficult time. My brain was all cooked. But
Your wife knew you had depression.
Yeah, she was supportive through that time. I was on tablets, but I said at the particular time, I was sat on the steps, came out of the bankruptcy court, and the first telephone call I got right from the bankruptcy court was from the gas board, and they said, "We can't supply you with gas anymore because you've now been made bankrupt." Which it was just like a knife in the heart, and so why? That was really bad, and it was at that particular point I was very close to doing something I shouldn't have done. But I got another phone call, and that was from a guy that I'd worked with in the past, Patrick. He was always very, very lively, and we were always laughing together, and he made me laugh. And it was just, that's the one conversation that changed my life, and I realised that actually to make people laugh, to be supportive of people throughout my life, and that's what I wanted to do. So I changed my life at that point, decided I wanted to do something different, and I wanted to help others, and that's where I then turned around. But it took a conversation from somebody else that helped me with that. So
before that, even though experiences in your life and, you know, signs from what you were succeeding at and what you were not succeeding at were showing you what your purpose might be, you hadn't actually found it.
That's right.
Sometimes you're accidentally on purpose and sometimes you weren't.
Yes.
But that's when you discovered, right, that's my raison d'etre.
That's
why I'm here.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Just, I think, in terms of adding value, because as you say, there is a lot of stigma about mental illness, even now, particularly with us men, and people not talking about it. And I think that also people don't understand the difference between being really sad or annoyed or angry or upset, whatever it is, or afraid even, and actually being depressed. So would you mind, if you can remember, what were the first signs that you were depressed that maybe you missed but other people are aware of? And at what point were you aware, I'm depressed, I need to go and see a doctor?
At that time, I think a lot of it is you don't want to get out of bed. And you start to lie in, you start to think, and the brain just really, you're thinking all the time about doing silly things and not really taking part in the in life. And
silly
in the
things,
world.
You mean suicidal?
Yeah, suicidal.
Right.
And I think that if I call that a silly thing, it's to undermine it, really. It's a serious matter. And to think about suicide, I thought of different ways that I would like to do, but probably because I was too chicken to do it is probably why I didn't do it.
But yet the rope, that's probably one of the hardest things to do, and that's what you're contemplating?
I was contemplating at the time.
Yeah.
It's always that I thought about four or five different ways as to how could I do this, and it's that elements that all added together to say there's something wrong. But again, you don't want to admit it to yourself because we're a man, you know. You go to the doctors and you say, I'm all right. You never admit and say, well, I'm suffering from depression. But I finally managed to pluck up the courage to go in and say, I am something wrong, not quite right. My head's not in the right place.
And how about your wife through this time? Was she saying to you, you know, Phil, I don't think you're right? Or
Probably not, because a lot of it and a lot of my depression resulted in a lot of anger. Although I never struck out, it was always anger and verbal abuse and verbal shouting. And I used to shout at myself. I'd swear and curse and shout. And I just felt bad afterwards, but it was always something that I did. And I just didn't know why I was doing it. And that's one of the things that happened.
I'll tell you what, we're going to give our audience a song. It's ironic, actually. The very first song that was in the system was Suicide is Painless by MASH.
Yes.
Because, you know, in order to bring an authentic conversation, and you're my evidence here, I didn't grill you particularly before you came on. I just wanted to have a fresh conversation. So we're going to play Meripiche Pagaya, very good Dunyar, very bad Loeg. Apparently that's what it's called. You can text in and let me know how badly I pronounced that if you like. So welcome back to the Culture Pot, the show that celebrates the music, the culture and the people of the world. And I'm sorry, Alicia Dixon, The Boy Does Nothing does sound like a good song, but we're going to carry on with the interview. So Phil, thank you very much for being so open about depression. If there's any show in the world you can be open about that kind of thing, it's this one. Thank Everyone you. Who listens to this show knows that I've been through it before. So I want you also to delve deep. I know it was a while ago, but I want you to delve into the issue of bankruptcy as well, because I can say to you as a self-employed person, I've had my moments. I got into a lot of debt, which thankfully are now controlled and managed, because when you're reinventing yourself, sometimes you have to take these risks. And I thought, what happens? What would happen to me if this happened? Is it the end of the world, or is it actually a whole new dawn that opens up? So talk us through the process as best you can.
Well, it's a difficult time because everything's taken off you, really. The whole process from start to finish was probably about 6 months. They announced that somebody's going to take you into court. You get a court date and you have to go into court and present yourself. Really, you lay yourself bare and you lay yourself open. You've got to declare everything. I actually declared a £2 premium bond, and that was taken off me as well, so they even cashed that in. So I literally had nothing. I couldn't have a bank account. And so there's a lot of problems around bankruptcy and having anything that a normal person would have that you just don't, or not able to get hold of. So no bank account. It was fortunate that I was able to work through my wife, that she could have a bank account, and I got paid in cash, that type of thing. So there's always a bit of a, and there is a stigma about it as well. People think going bankrupt, but you do hear people in the media, famous people who've gone bankrupt 3, 4, 5 times, and you think, well, actually, I don't want to do that. And they do warn you in the court as well that if you do it again, then the consequences will be worse. But sitting in the court, it's a little bit of a relief because your debts have now gone, but you've now got to rebuild your life, and you've got a bankruptcy label around your head for 10 years. So it's quite a long time to hold that stigma. But from there, I rebuilt my life, and I think that's important to know that you can come out of bankruptcy. You've just got to think, I need support. I need support from other people close by. We lost a few friends at the time, which was quite interesting. People didn't want to be attached to us because, ooh, if you've gone into bankruptcy, then maybe we can. So they felt as if they didn't want to talk to us. And there were
maybe
two
they
or three
weren't friends in the first place.
That might have been it. And they
request the best beats in town. Call 01484 817 705. Text or WhatsApp your message to 07444 202 155. That's 07444 202 155.
So we're recovering from our deafness, but we're having a chuckle because I actually spoke to Phil about this before and said, you know, if you see me moving these sliders, I said to him, it's because I'm looking out ahead and making sure that, you know, we don't get caught out by something. But at some stage, we'll be talking, we'll be looking at each other in the eye, and he's telling me his story. I'm sitting there intensely. And what happened? I got caught out by the sweeper. I thought, I'll just let you hear me. I won't knock the slider down. You can hear it. So we're back anyway. Phil, how are your ears now after that?
Yeah, they're all right.
They're all right. That's awful. They don't sound like very good friends to me.
I think that probably is it. They were scared. They were probably in a similar situation, but just didn't want to be associated with anybody who was going through that. But we've got 5 or 6 close friends who've stayed with us, and that's who you know when your friends are. And we didn't want money. We didn't expect them to give us anything. We just wanted their friendship. And that was the hard bit for some people to understand. But you don't want anything, really. You know, if somebody comes around and says, hi, hello, how are you, then that's really more important than anything else. And it's quite important that if you do know of anybody in that position, go around and say hello. They're not going to bite you. It's a case of they just need the support, and they need that emotional support as well. So,
well, one thing I'm still not clear on, though, is if you weren't allowed to have any bank accounts, presumably no plastic cards, no nothing, how did you reintegrate yourself into a normal society where you get a job and they pay you that way?
It's all quite difficult. There are some bank accounts and there are some plastic that you can get. You will pay higher for them, but it's a case of then rebuilding your credit history and rebuilding your life back again, but you have to do it gradually. But as I say, my wife had a bank account. I was then able to, and if you declare it and you're open and you're honest with the banks, they will let you have an account, and then you just prove to them that you can support yourself and maintain a bank account in a good way. So
once they write up, when you're bankrupt, they do write off the debts completely. It's not like they're going to now come for you to take a percentage of anything.
Hopefully not. After 10 years, they're supposed to leave you alone at that point. So hopefully it's been a long time now since that happened. We're over 20 years now. But it's a case of that technically within that 10 years, if I'd have won the lottery, then they would have had the right to come along and take that money back from there. But it's something that you still have to live with. I did pay some of my debtors back afterwards, but in different ways as well. Just a case of having to live with it. It's a difficult time. It was a difficult time, but I was able to rebuild my life, and I think it's important for people to know that you can do that.
I think it's amazing that your wife as well, you know, that you've been together 42 years, mm-hmm. because I think that even when people genuinely love each other, if there's anything that's going to split up a family, it's financial woes.
It is, and I was very lucky that she supported me, and we've still supported each other throughout all our troubles. So,
what does your wife do?
She's now retired. She used to work in a bank, so which again is always difficult because people get the stigma that if you're working in a bank, you're after the money. But we were never like that. It's just a case of, you know, it's her life is hers, mine's mine. We live and we support each other.
Was her working career compromised at all because you were bankrupt?
No, being out of work, it was compromised. So again, you have to. I had to get benefits. So I was on the benefits system, three kids to support. But if she works more than so many hours, then we couldn't get the full benefits. So it was always that difficult time of trying to support the children. The main thing to us was that we needed to feed the kids, keep them warm, and maintain ourselves as a family. So that's what we did.
This is really interesting for me, Phil, because I've got the slide deck ready for this talk that I'm giving to these kids tomorrow. I'm giving them a talk tomorrow, and then I'll be talking to some older kids on Friday. And I've called the talk, What's Your Story? Yeah? And the idea is that it's about recognising that in order to sell, you've got to have a story, right? You know, the story might even be something as simple as Joe wanted a mobile phone that would work underground. We designed this one and he bought it, and it actually cost him less than your ordinary phone. And that's your story, isn't it? Somebody mm-hmm. had a need, somebody had a niche need, and you fitted it. So your story at the age of 40 odd was somebody who was good at selling, loved people, had reached the highs, got married, had a house, then lost everything.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, gone through bankruptcy, about to hang himself with a rope, realised that there's something more to life, and you found a new purpose, which is for you to be helping other people, right? So talk us through now. We've took you to rock bottom. You're now rewriting your story
mm-hmm.
the way you want it, yeah? Because this is what I'm going to be talking about with these kids, so right. it's interesting to hear. So your story at the moment wasn't fully written by you, but from the age of 40 onwards, you then started to rewrite your story. How'd you go about that?
I actually was very lucky. I went on a particular training course. There was a professional speaker, and throughout the afternoon, he was talking about people. He did training, and he offered a boot camp to help speakers become speakers. And I thought, that's actually something I'd love to do. I'd like to become a professional speaker. And so I went on his boot camp, and it cost me quite a lot of money. To 3 days in a hotel in the middle of England on the hottest weekend of the year as well at the time.
Who was that? You
was Frank Furness, he's called. Absolute brilliant, first-class professional speaker. Been in the business a long time. And I resonated well with Frank and went on his training course. But throughout the training course, people mentioned an organisation called Toastmasters, Toastmasters International. And I what is Toastmasters? And I came home and I found out that Toastmasters, it's a worldwide organisation, and it helps people improve their speaking skills and, more importantly, their confidence. And I found out there was a group meeting in Leeds. It was the only group in this side of the Pennines in the north of England, and I went along to this group, and to me, being very shy, quite difficult to walk in front of, into a room full of people, I went to the hotel, the Crown Plaza in Leeds, to a room full of, there were 50 odd people in the room, and that terrified me. I walked in the room, these people were doing speeches and standing in front of an audience, and I thought, I could never ever do that. But I stuck at it, and they asked me, did you want to stand in front of the audience and do a 1 minute, what they call a table topic, an impromptu speech? And I was scared to
death. How long did you have to talk for?
I didn't. I almost ran out of the room and said, no, I don't want to do that. I couldn't stand in front of the room. And then I thought, well, I could see the power of Toastmasters. I thought, this is absolutely phenomenal. So I went back to the second meeting, and they said, do you want to do an impromptu? And I stood up and I thought, I can do this. forced myself to stand in front of the audience. And
about 50, you said.
You're supposed to stand there for... Yeah, there were about 50 people.
Yeah.
You're supposed to stand and speak for a minute, so at least 60 seconds. And my first table topic, I did 23 seconds. Couldn't wait to sit down because I was so scared, so nervous.
And did you speak quickly?
I did. Amazing what you do. Yeah. And I just thought I couldn't do that. But I forced myself to keep going because I saw the power of Toastmasters. And over that time, I grew in confidence. I was able to stand in front of more people, so gradually speaking to 30, 40 people at a time. There's a whole program in Toastmasters International where you have to deliver a number of speeches. And one of the speeches, it talks about you have to use hand gestures. And I was still using notes and reading from my script because I was so nervous. But I thought, I've got to use my hands and I've got to use gestures. What can I do? So I wrote my whole speech in pen on my hands. So I had my opening line, my point one, my point two on my left hand, and my point three and my conclusion on my right hand. So I could use my hands in front of my face and actually still read from my hands and read the script. And so that's how nervous I was. By the time I'd finished, my hands were a black, inky mess. But I managed to get through 7.5 minutes of a speech without any notes at that time. Again, it's all about confidence, and I just wasn't particularly confident. But that was over 15 years ago, and since then I've been able to help others. In fact, one of the projects that you have to do is help a new member. You have to mentor them into speaking, and one of my first speakers that I mentored was a guy called Richard McCann. I think you've had Richard on the program. He's a member of the professionals. I was his mentor when he was in Toastmasters. So he's probably one of my early successes, I think. And Richard's gone on to be a fantastic speaker. And that, again, makes me feel proud that I was there at his early stage and able to mentor him. He wanted to be a speaker and wanted to be a professional speaker. And I helped him with his first few speeches, which is I feel very proud of it. But that's what I love doing. I love helping people and love helping them. And as you say, found my raison d'etre of saying, this is what I want to do. I want to help people speak and actually gain confidence. We had a couple in the group in Leeds at one particular time, Dinesh and Vishali. And Dinesh was the one, he was the man of the house, and he wanted to be a speaker.
What's Dinesh's second name?
Calgood.
Okay.
So they came along. She just sat in the background, and we kept asking her every week, and she was there for about 6 months. Do you want to speak? Would you like to stand? Do you want to speak? And she just didn't want to take part at all. She was very shy. And I empathised a lot with Vishali because I had been through that process. And gradually, we got her to speak. And I was actually able to evaluate her first speech. We give feedback to the speaker. And I was proud to evaluate Vishala. She was very shy, very nervous, and I gave her some constructive feedback. But I was very proud more so when she asked me in her 10th speech, when you become what's known as a competent communicator, a competent Toastmaster, she asked me if I'd do her evaluation. And to see the difference that Vishali had taken over the 9 month period that she went from speech one to speech 10, the difference in that lady was absolutely phenomenal. The confidence that she had, she is a brilliant speaker, and she went on to become the area governor, and she did a lot of things that really I felt very proud of Vishali for doing that. And that's what I think Toastmasters has done for me. It's given me confidence. It's given me the ability to be able to stand in front of an audience, but also to be able to help others, and that's what I love doing.
Because it makes you realise that you're having an impact on the world, that there'd be a big gap if you weren't here, not just a gap in your own income.
Yes. Income doesn't really matter anymore now. It's a case of I know what I like doing. I like helping people, and that's what I do. And people say, how much do you charge? And I think, you know, I actually like to do it. Not that I'm doing it for free, but
you've got to. I understand exactly what you mean.
I like to help, and I like to give, and I like to give back, and I think that's important because I've been through the mill and I've seen how a lack of confidence can impact everybody's life. So I've worked for a number of organisations. Speakers Trust is a charity that I work for, helping youngsters, 14 to 18 year olds, improve their confidence. And when you see the youngsters being able to, well, not wanting to speak at the beginning of the session and yet then standing in front of an audience speaking for 1 to 2 minutes is just incredible. And it's that confidence that we ought to be able to give youngsters these days and give them a voice, because
even if they're not going to go into speaking,
absolutely everybody needs a voice and everybody has a voice. Everybody needs to have that confidence to be able to speak in front of an audience, and I think that that's a very powerful thing to do. It's about communication. It's about communicating with others and communicating professionally, and that's what I try and do, is just help them increase their confidence, increase confidence in communication skills.
I'm going to put it out there to you, if you want to send us a question, Phil, maybe you've got to talk, or maybe there's an issue that you've had in the past. I remember one time when I was about 23 doing a psychology degree, and I gave a presentation and I felt as though I had how shall I say, cojones of steel, right? But it didn't stop my legs from shaking ridiculously when I stood up in front of everybody, but obviously that was then. So you might have a tactic for stopping that happen. So if you've got a question for Phil, do get in touch. I think we deserve a little bit of a coffee now. So we're going to leave you with the dulcet sounds of Ravi Shankar, and it's one of his ragas. And that's going to take you to the news, and then we'll be back with the Culture Pot afterwards, when Phil can tell us more about how his career kicked off and all the different places he's been to in the world. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Culture Pot, the show that celebrates the music, the culture and the people of the world. If you've just joined us this wonderful afternoon, I'm interviewing Phil LaFunnel. His real name's Phil Heath. He's a public speaker, trainer and MC, and his life story has been really inspirational. So Phil has told us all about his career in sales, and how, because he wasn't really matching his true purpose in life, sometimes he was with it, sometimes he wasn't, but he wasn't consciously aware of why he was here. Eventually he got so depressed, things went wrong, business went down the pan, went bankrupt, was on medication for depression, and was even going to hang himself. He's still got that rope today, but he's still got his life as well, I'm pleased to say. Even though he's had a near miss only a few months ago with a triple heart bypass. So, Phil, it's time for you to tell us all about how life unfolded. You joined Toastmasters, and you've been talking about how good that was for building your confidence.
Yep.
And at what point did you start to speak professionally, or what's, you know, I know you wanted to do it, where was your break?
I think probably about 8 years ago, while I was at Toastmasters, I also met somebody from the Professional Speaking Association, Clive Gott. Unfortunately, we lost Clive a few years ago, but Clive was my mentor in the PSA. I went along to the PSA and joined, and I found it a great inspirational place to want to become a professional speaker and to learn how to speak better and speak more. And that's the ethos of the Professional Speaking Association. So I joined and found a lot of great people in that community as well. But I thought, well, I can do this because I see people doing it. I felt that I could be a professional speaker. And since that time, I was actually looking up with the job that I do as well. I can go, and I've been to different countries. I've probably hit about 12, 14 countries in the last 10 years. Different places, different cultures. And I found that very interesting as well, was learning and teaching in different cultures and in different languages. And I love that as well, because it's about helping people out there as well, out there in the rest of the world.
So do you speak primarily about sales?
I have another sort of string to my bow, is that I work in an industry that nobody ever realises is important, but I work in the standards industry, so anything to do with an ISO, and yeah. I talk and speak about standards. So I help people improve their businesses through standards, and I've been able to teach people in different countries about standards, and so I stand on a stage or I speak in front of an audience and teach them about standards. But it's all about communicating and effective communication about standards and what they mean to us, because if it wasn't for standards, we probably wouldn't be able to survive. I always quote we need BSEN 228 and BSEN 590, and everybody looks at me in amazement and says, I've no idea what that is. Well, that's unleaded petrol and diesel, and if it wasn't for those, you probably wouldn't be able to get move around the country. So it's standards are very important, not only this country, but worldwide.
So what you do is really lift the lid on the terminology and what looks like a really bog standard, excuse the pun, boring industry, and make it into something tangible.
I make it lively, and I think it's important that we should understand what they mean to us, what we need to do with standards, and how we can actually take them worldwide. So standards are very important to us all. I just make it fun, and I think that's the, and I speak a lot about standards as well.
Okay, I just want to point out just how truly professional this man is, because I said to him, look, this is this clock here in the corner of this screen tells you how long you've got before a track finishes. But me, in a fleeting moment of professionalism, I'd already prepared the slider for the next track, which is down now. But Phil, bless him, pointed to the screen, and do carry on doing that, Phil, because I don't want to get caught out by a slider. So do carry on doing that.
Yeah. I could do this job.
Well, you should. Yeah, I would say to anybody, it's a different kettle of fish. I've had people who have spoken professionally in front of people, on a stage, face to face, who the idea of coming on radio, that's really scared the hell out of them. I can't actually remember ever being afraid of being on radio. I think the very first time I came in here, and it was my own show, and I was sat here, I was filling in for somebody, so I wasn't even asking anybody else questions. I was sitting here, and it was like me and the music. And I think most people are gathered by now, but although I like bringing culture to the table, I like to bring people to the table, I'm not really a muso. And I know for a fact there's a slot next week for somebody to do a Hindi show. I'd be useless at it. I'd be just going, that was a good track, I liked the drums, and that was, who was it? Really badly pronounced the name, and then in the next one we've got this. So I always knew that was not going to be my bag. But it comes down to this thing about purpose again, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that we're all far more capable than we think we are if we identify what we're good at. So tomorrow when I'm talking to people in schools, I'll say to them, if they're going for the wrong jobs, they're not going to succeed. You've got to go for the right job for you. And I think that's something, certainly for my generation and probably yours, we weren't taught that. It was about just get a job.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think the important thing is, if you're not happy in your job, then you're in the wrong job. You need to think of your job as being, it's your life, it's what you want to do. And if you don't want to do it, then find something else to do. So find something that you really want to do. And I'm now in a position where I really love what I do. And I love helping people, and that's important for me and important for the people that I help. So it's great. But you were saying earlier about travelling overseas. I visited a number of different countries, which has been, for me, culturally valuable. I love every minute of travelling to different countries. The unfortunate thing is, I do tell the story in front of some of my training courses, is that I visited Egypt. I did a whole series of projects in Egypt. And when I left Egypt, there was a riot in Tehran Square. I moved into the Turkey project. And when I left Turkey, there were riots in Ankara. And then I moved into the Ukraine. And when I left the Ukraine, they invaded the Ukraine. So I'm hoping that Huddersfield's going to be safe when I leave here, Martin. I just fingers crossed that things are okay when I go.
It's funny you say that, because when I came to Leeds, Leeds United was at the top of the game. And then as soon as I decided I was going to support Leeds United, because the Leeds people have been so good to me, that was when it went absolutely pear-shaped and came out the Premiership and just dropped and dropped and dropped. It was awful. So we're going to have to go to the ads in about 16 seconds. So what we'll do when we come back is, I want you to take us on your journey around the world, sharing what you learned about the different cultures. All right?
Okay.
Great. Listen to the Culture Pop with Martin Morrison and Phil Heath. We'll be right back. This is too good a track to turn down. I love those beats. So this is I Believe by Diphtheria, This is Martin Morrison on the Culture Pod, and I'm chatting to Phil Heath, otherwise known as Phil the Funnel. So you've been to about, I think you said about 12 different countries around the world. And I know you and I have already spoken off the record about some of the experiences. So where do you want to start?
Wherever you like. I think culture, you talked about culture. I think it's important to respect different cultures. And when I go to a different country, I always try and find out how to say please, how to say thank you, how to say yes and no, and the important words that we each use in different languages. I do say on my training that I speak 52 languages, but I can ask for Coca-Cola in all countries, so it's a key thing that there are some words that travel. But I think it's important that you should know at least some polite words, and that's, to me, that's so important. If you also try and speak those words to people, then they actually, they'll fall over themselves to help you. It's when, especially being English, traditionally we've gone around the world and we just burst in through the doors and expect people to speak English, and I don't think we should do that. We should respect culture and we should respect languages.
Which is one of the reasons why you're here, because we're peas in a pod in that way. Because I was a working class lad from Toxteth. I never believed I'd end up going anywhere else, and that's why I didn't learn any other languages, not when I was a kid. When I was around 10 or 11, my primary school teacher was teaching us Spanish, and for some reason, I love words. Everything he taught us stayed in my mind. And then, but when I was in senior school and I had the opportunity, we had to learn Latin. We had to learn French. And I took Spanish on as well. But again, I wasn't really bothered for those languages until I got to 21. And then I went to Spain. And I realised that I remembered everything I'd been taught. And it just didn't seem right to talk in English. So the first time I said to somebody, ¿Qué hora es? But what time is it? Just a look on their face was enough to say to me, I'm going to carry on with this.
Yeah.
So, do you want me to try you with a language then?
Oh.
Should I put you on the spot?
Not really, no.
Or do you want to volunteer any then?
Just, I speak and I understand basic French, Spanish, Italian, but it's just a case of understanding, and when I listen and I hear those languages, I also say please and thank you in Turkish, Arabic.
Okay.
So it's all a case of, I think it's polite that you should do that. But in a case of, as well, when you leave the country, you always forget as well, because I'm getting old now, so I've got a bad memory.
I promised my audience that I was going to learn more Urdu than I had when I first came, but I don't think I've really moved on. I know how to say, Apka kya hal hai, which is how are you. Hal means health, by the way. Mm-hmm. So kya hal hai, how health is, I guess. Mera naam Martin hai. My name is Martin, or Apka kya naam hai. I think that's how you say it. What's your name? And I know shukra in Arabic is thanks. How do you say please in Arabic?
In Arabic, I can't remember, to be honest.
Oh,
shukran.
I put you on the spot. I'm sorry. So, in terms of doing as they do in Rome, being like a Roman, you were telling me about Dubai.
Yes.
Do you want to go and share that story with
us? Yeah, I was on a training course in Dubai, and I'm a white middle-aged man, and we had a great relationship with the course, the delegates on the course, and it was a fantastic course. But one of the young ladies who was quite open, very friendly, didn't dress in the normal Muslim dress that I would associate with that particular country, but she offered me a lift back to my hotel, and I'm a married man, and it was a case of I really don't think I should do that. And I said to her, I don't think I should, and I got somebody else to take me back to the hotel. So it's a case of, you've got to respect the culture, but also be aware and be mindful that although we had a good relationship, but it was a professional relationship and I didn't overstep the line. And I think that's so important, that you've got to be aware of different cultures as well.
I think also from a legal perspective, a country can look like it's quite laid back and forward thinking until you suddenly find yourself breaking some sort of rule.
Yes.
And being in a car as a married person with someone who's not married, one or both of you could have got into an awful lot of trouble. I mean, my gut feeling says that that would have been more likely in Saudi than Dubai. But when was that?
That was probably about 8 years ago. So it's again, is it, the culture is changing across the world, but I still think it's important to respect different religions, different cultures, and it's so important to understand the local traditions as well. But I refused to do it because I didn't, and I wasn't quite clear as to what could have happened or what possibly could have happened. So I just said no. I wasn't prepared to get into a car with her, which is, I suppose, was it right? Was it wrong? I don't know.
It's probably one of the reasons you've been married for 42 years.
Well, there is that as well, yeah.
Yeah. So, what other countries would you like to talk about?
Well, I think I found a lot of work in Turkey, and I worked in Ankara quite a lot. And I think that's a very, again, difficult country to be in, that some parts of the country are very, very strict. And yet, when I was in Ankara, it's such an open city and quite cosmopolitan, which I was quite surprised about. And I found it an interesting way of life. But in the other part of Turkey, I have visited Istanbul, for example, and they're visiting the Blue Mosque. What a fantastic place. But there you see, you've got Jesus and the prophets all alongside each other, and you think, why can't we all do that anyway? And so you've got Allah, Jesus, sat there together, let's all be like that. And I've always felt that we should just get on with each other and be part of everybody's lives, rather than trying to, so many wars in religious wars, let's just get on with life.
Yeah, I mean, that's the good thing about Sangam that I like. You know, they took me on as a white British guy in an Asian radio station. And I think I said to you before you came on the show, the slogan for Sangam, which of course means confluence anyway, togetherness or flowing together, is Dilonko Malane Vala. I'm getting better at pronouncing that, I think, which means bringing hearts together. But it's funny that we've talked about that topic of, if you like, different religions and different cultures, because this morning I couldn't sleep, so I got up very early. And I stumbled upon a YouTube clip about these people called the, I'm trying to remember how to pronounce it, the Uyghur people in China. Now, the Uyghur people are originally from Kazakhstan, and they're Muslims. And the Chinese, they only want people to have one culture. Mm-hmm. You're Chinese, and you believe in our mission and our dream. And what they're doing in a place, particularly, I think it was Sichuan, I think that's how you pronounce it, in this predominantly Muslim Uyghur area, is they're going in at night and they're taking the adults to re-education, basically concentration camps, where they just drill it into these people for 2 years, 4 years, 5 years at a time. You're Chinese, you believe in the Chinese dream. The children are just whisked away to a school where they live, like an orphanage where they're re-educated. And I was thinking, probably in 100 years' time, they'll have what they want, which is just everybody being uniform and the same. But at what cost? Mm. It's terrible, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Treating people in that way.
Yeah, we should just let people get on with what they want to do. And just let's all get on together. That's what I always said. So to me, it doesn't matter what culture, what race, religion, creed you are, who you support, I'll still speak to you, even though you're from Liverpool. So
I've had that one many times. So tell me, I'm going to hit you with a question that you probably haven't had, I hope, because I like to do this with guests. You know, different peoples and different cultures have got, if you like, stereotypical personality traits, if you like. Do you find that different countries have got different ways of selling?
Yes, they have. And I think it's, again, I've come across that in different places, that certainly being in places like Morocco, Istanbul, and in Egypt, in Cairo, it's a very forward way of selling. They'll just come and hit you with the, you know, and they're very persistent. I think that's a real different culture. So you, they'll just, you've got to buy, and they'll just, and you have to be very polite and just say no, thank you, say it in their language as well, which they quite like, but they'll still be persistent. And I think when you see that in the UK, we just don't see that type of selling at all. But it's always fascinating to see that they just want to sell, and they're persistent. They're just like my grandchildren. Can I have an ice cream? And they'll just carry on until you say no, and then you give in.
But presumably that's based on almost a cultural game between buyer and seller over there.
I think it is, and I think we do that, but in a more subtle way in this country. We tend to be a little bit more subtle, but you will see. I was taught in the very early days of my selling career how to sell a car, for example, in the Ford, and they all start near the inside, near side wing, and they'll start there, but they have what they call the 100 touch points, and what they'll do is they'll walk around the car and they'll point out something or get you to touch the car until they finally get you around to the driver's door and then get you to open the driver's door so you're touching the car. And then when you get in the car, they'll then say, just picture yourself inside that car, so they make you imagine that you're driving that car. And then they'll put the killer question is, how good does that feel? And it's all about emotion in this country, and we tend to use more emotional sell than other countries and different cultures, so we're more of that type of selling. It's emotion. It's about, and people never buy price, they always buy emotion. You'll always buy something because you want it, because you like the feel, the touch, or the smell of it, so that's why we always buy. So if you can relate to that in sales, you'll be successful.
But I'm saying that, though, when it comes to price, in some cultures you are expected to try to barter and to ask people to come down in price.
You are.
I always do in this country, but most people don't.
So do I. My wife hates that. When I say, can I get some discount because I'm a Yorkshireman, and she always tells me off because I'm not supposed to do that in this country. But if you don't ask, you don't get. So I've always said, let's just ask. Why not? And most people will say yes or no, and if they say no, that's fine, we move on. But if they say yes, at least I'm going to benefit from that by getting a discount.
So there you go. I'll be talking to you more about how to get the best price, but for now, let's have a listen to a track. This is Don't You Worry Child. It's Swedish House Mafia featuring John Martin. So that's Meredilki Mafil by Dildil Semile. And I hope I pronounced that correctly. Phil, again, thank you very much for sharing so much with us today.
My pleasure.
So I'm just wondering, because we're reaching the end of the show now, the last 20 minutes, you know, I've realised that, one, I forgot to thank Saeed for his show before. We got to see Saeed this week before he went away, and just for once, the studio wasn't like a sauna after he'd left. He doesn't normally put the air conditioning on. You've got us until 5 o'clock, and then at 5 o'clock, Gia will be in, hopefully with Javid. I didn't see him last week, maybe he'll be here today. So until then, I want to pick your brains a little bit more, Phil, with regards to different cultures and selling. This is going to sound really naughty, but I was going to say to you, because you teach people about selling, I was going to ask you to do your version of Sell Me This Pen. Yeah, and even better, yeah, after you've done the first one to me, you might want to have a little think about how they would do it in Germany, how they would do it in different cultures, and maybe teach you a thing or two about attitudes to sales in different cultures through the pen. Is that too much?
We'll try.
You're feeling playful. There you go. Sell me that pen.
Well, the one thing, I was actually one of my first sales jobs that I went for. My instructor, my boss, said to me, here's a pen, sell me that pen, but take a few minutes to look at the pen, what does it do, and then sell me it. So I spent 5 minutes looking at this pen, which at the moment I've got a Bic Biro in my hand. It's got a black top, it's got a black insert and a black end, and then when I pull the top off, I can then see the nib, and I went through all the things that this could do.
You've done this already.
So I thought about what this would do, and then what I then said was, I held it in my own hands, and I said to him, What I'm showing you here is this pen. This is an absolutely super writing implement. What it's got is this top, and this top will actually help protect the nib for if it goes in your pocket, for example, stop the ink coming out. So the top is very important. When you take the top off, you can either put it back onto the pen at the top to balances the pen, which is quite good, and also you can clip that into your pocket. So there are lots of valuable benefits with having the top, but also this nib, it's such a fantastic pen that when you actually put that to paper, you'll feel the flow of the nib. And I spent 5 minutes talking to him about this pen, and he said, just let me show you something. And he took the pen off me and he said, what I'd like to do, he said, I'd like to introduce you to this pen. And he said, and I'd like to just show you what this pen will do. And he immediately then did this. He leant across and he put it in my hands, which is what I've just done with Martin. And he said, just feel the weight of that pen. And so I've now got the pen in my hand. What he said was, if you just take the top off and just feel how smooth that top comes on and off, and how simple it is to use that. Now, that top could be used to clip into your pocket, for example, so you could show how you could put that into your pocket. But also, he said, just feel how that writes on this piece of paper. And he gave me a piece of paper, and he said, just see how easy that nib now writes. Do you feel that you could write an expensive check with that pen?
I feel like I can write like a doctor with that pen. My handwriting's getting worse by the minute.
But that's the key thing that he showed me in sales.
How
and he
does
demonstrated
it feel?
Was that emotion. He actually put the pen in my hand. So throughout the whole presentation, he didn't have anything to do with the pen. He wasn't touching it. He made it that I was touching the pen. I was feeling the pen, and I also then felt how it felt to write with that pen. And that's so important in sales. Now, in Germany, for example, you might actually be instructed to, you will write with this pen. You will, and I suppose we get this stereotypical example of what we should and shouldn't do. But Germans are more instructive, so they'd tell you the characteristics of the pen. They'd be more interested in the structure of the pen, how the plastic feels or how the metal feels. They'd then be telling you all about that structure, how it was made. So that's a difference in us and them.
Because they like design.
They like the design. They like to know how things are engineered. So a lot of things around in the German culture and the German culture of selling is all about giving you that engineering background, so you know how well built that pen is and how strong it will be and how long it will last, because it's engineering and it's engineered by a German, so it will be built to last. So that's the way that they would approach the sale.
Now that's interesting. I'm gonna interrupt a little bit, because you see, when I look at this pen, this is a I can't say it. It's a household. It's one of those names that we use generically for pens, right? Which means it's cost about 20 pence, mm-hmm. right? So I'm gonna take a stab at this. Have you done courses in America?
I've been and played with Americans, yes.
Because my guess is that the Americans would say that this pen is no good, because it's not presenting the right image,
mm-hmm.
and they would say you need a pen that is reassuringly expensive to show how important you are and how successful you are.
Mm-hmm.
Am I on the right lines there?
You are, and that's one example of how the Americans actually spent probably, I think it was quite into the millions. They actually made a pen which is all steel. It was a pressurized pen, but it actually was a pen developed and designed to write in space. And they spent a fortune on this pen to develop that. So you can see that what they did was they did it the right way. We did it the American way, lads. And the Russians, they took a pencil, because it still writes in space and it writes upside down. And so the key thing is, it's how we approach these things. The pen, what do you need it to do? You know, we never buy a drill for the drill. We never buy a drill bit for the drill bit. How excited can you get? You don't want a 3/8 drill bit. You want a 3/8 hole. What do you need? You actually need the result of that. So what do I need this pen to do? And it's all about that relativity. Now, the more expensive the pen, then that's about the feel. That's about the comfort. And we buy pens, we purchase things on emotion, so we never think about the price, but we'll use a pen for exactly the same reason, whether it's a 23 pence pen that's a plastic pen, or whether it's a £2,000 pen It's the same thing. It gets us the same. You're still going to write me
this
check.
There's no way I'd spend more money. And this brings me on to the next thing. I notice you're not wearing a watch.
No.
Now, I don't wear a watch. And I'll be blunt with you. I don't wear a watch, partly for philosophical reasons. There's lots of ways we can find out the time when we need to, but really we should try to be here now. So if I need a watch, I will have one. But secondly, I just tend to be allergic. I'm not going to spend a fortune on something I don't really want. I tend to be allergic to the back of them, so I take them off. And I was thinking, when you were talking about the pen and what the Americans did, I was thinking about these watches that will still work at like 2,000 feet beneath sea level.
Mm-hmm.
And you look at the type of guy who's wearing one, and you're like, you can't even swim, let alone going 2,000 feet beneath sea level. What's all that about?
Yeah, I think that's... Do you need a watch? I haven't worn a watch for a number of years, primarily from a vanity reason, is that I went abroad one time and I was tanned and underneath my watch was white, and I was like, oh, actually, I don't like that. And it was all hot and sweaty, and I thought, I just can't be bothered wearing a watch anymore. So for probably 20 years now, I haven't worn a watch. But like you say, you can find the time from other people, but also... I find it's a fantastic communication tool, because rather than me having to find the time, I can actually speak to somebody and say, excuse me, can I ask you the time? And that's important, because now I'm communicating with another person. So again, it's part of my rehabilitation, but it's also a pointer for everybody else out there. Why not speak to somebody else and ask them the time? So start with communication. Start speaking to somebody else.
Well, you know, I don't know who it was who said this to me, but shy kids don't get the sweets. And I think that whenever you ask somebody the time or speak to them anyway, you never know what's going to come from that conversation. Don't let me forget, by the way, I've got to tell you about a young lady that was at the PSA meeting the other day, who I never actually got to meet. Do you know Carrie Lamb?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so when I tell you the story with Carrie Lamb, it's really freaky in terms of coincidences. But that reminded me, because me and Carrie have been talking a lot about near-death experiences, and I know that you'd had this triple bypass.
Yeah. Right?
And a lot of people who have some kind of cardiac arrest often do have near-death experience. And when they come back, things like watches... The whole thing changes their electromagnetic field, and watches won't work for them.
Right.
Electrical things break down. And for a moment I thought, is he going to tell me I almost died on the operating table, and ever since then my watch has not worked? So tell me anyway about that's another thing I wanted to talk to you about, health. Did you know that you had a heart problem?
I found a couple of years ago I was struggling to breathe. I was diagnosed with what's known as angina.
Yeah.
And I had pains in my chest.
How old were you then?
How old am I now? It was 2 years ago, so I was 61 then.
Okay.
So I found this problem. Mainly I was walking home from the pub one night and found I couldn't get home. I was in such a lot of pain. So I finally... As we do as men, we don't want to talk to anybody about it. I never told anybody. I didn't tell the wife. I didn't tell anybody. And then I just finally decided I'd go to see the doctors. And the doctor referred me into the cardiologist who diagnosed this problem, which was known as angina, and put me on some tablets. I was okay for a while, but then over the last year or so, it's been getting progressively worse. And what they saw on the test was that a couple of the arteries inside my heart were constricted, and one of them was actually deformed. So I think it wasn't cholesterol or anything like that. It was just not working correctly. And that's obviously gone over a period of years. So blood wasn't getting into the right part of the heart, or enough blood wasn't getting in there, which is why I was having the problem. I came into September last year, had an angiogram, I had a few more tests, and they said they would perform this triple heart bypass, it took place on the 25th of March, and it's been absolutely fantastic. I have all the credit in the world to the surgeons and the team at the LGI in Leeds, absolutely superb team of people. And I was out, I went in on the Sunday, so it was at this time on the 25th of March that I went in, And 7 days later on the Sunday, I was back out again, walking.
Wow.
Just a phenomenal experience. And so it's a
And what's the conversation like before you go in? Is there risks they're saying around and say you might not come out?
You might not come out. There is always a risk with any operation like that. During the week, my lung collapsed, so I was in a bit of a state at the time. I couldn't breathe properly. My heart was in what they call arterial rhythm, something of that nature, but I just got on with it, did what they asked me to do, did what they told me to do. They actually managed to reinflate the lung, by which time, by the end of the week, I was breathing properly, and still in a little bit of pain. I can't lift too much at the moment, but that's all just as you do in the normal recovery period. But 3 months on, I feel absolutely fantastic.
And what exactly is involved in a triple bypass?
Well, in a triple, they take a vein out of your leg. So I've got a big chunk out of my leg at the moment. And then they also reroute one of the major arteries in the heart. And what they do is, essentially, the heart is a muscle, and it's just not getting enough blood or enough oxygen into that muscle. So what they do is they just reroute some of the blood vessels round into the bottom end of the heart to put blood into there, which then gives it more oxygen, which then allows it to breathe more. And what they did say was that you've got now an extended chance of life. So, touch wood, I've now got a potential longer period of life than I would have had if I hadn't had it. So
when you first get this, because you know we normally link the heart with emotions, you're terrified of anything winding you up, you know. Don't wind him up, he's on a triple bypass. Or,
well, I think a lot of people saw that, and certainly my wife, she was planning on that I was going to be incapacitated for quite a long time. And she was quite surprised, along with others, that and they kept saying, "You're ill." No, I'm not ill. I'm actually very well right now. And although I was suffering from some symptoms and some pain before I went in, after I came out, I just felt tremendous. So, and I think it's given me a new lease of life. It's given me a new outlook on life. I've relaxed. I've calmed down. I drive a lot slower because I'm just now appreciating the beauty of things around us. I've just come back from a week in Scotland and just enjoyed being the two of us in the countryside in Scotland, which is a beautiful place. And so that's another country I've visited.
Whereabouts did you go?
We went to just up from Loch Lomond. So beautiful.
I went
place,
there a few years ago.
Yeah.
A place called Arrachar.
All right.
Wonderful. First time I'd ever been there, even though I've got a Scottish name. 2 years ago now. In fact, I was actually saying last night I want to go back there. Wonderful place. I always want to go into the, you know, just when you see the big mountains and they're so green and inviting, you just want to stop the car and go and hug a tree.
You do.
You know, although I've got a new paranoia about going to the countryside now because of ticks. If you get bitten by a tick, you can end up with this Lyme's disease.
That's exactly the same as if you were thinking about going on stage. It's all about you pre-preparing your mind to say, this something's going to happen. And really, you've just got to embrace it. Just go out there and just do it. If you get a tick, then so what? And I always see that, you know, I had this problem with my heart. But there is always somebody worse off than yourself. I just keep saying, I'm fine.
Just live life. It's like, I've got diabetes, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
What I'm thinking is, look, we get a lot of people listening to this show who are entrepreneurs, and they might want you to come in and talk to them about sales or talk to their sales team. How can they get in touch with you, Phil?
My website is philheath.com, available on there. My mobile is on there as well, so people can always contact me. I'm on Twitter at Phil Hea, so on Twitter, and I'm on LinkedIn as well as Phil Heath. If you actually see Phil the Gift Heath, that's a different guy. It's not me. I'm Phil the Funnel.
Okay, so on that note, we've got a small sweeper, and then we've got almost 2 minutes of Miss Independent by Neo, which can lead us up to the news. But you've been listening to the Culture Pot on Radio Sangam with Martin Morrison. I've been chatting to Phil Heath. Thank you very much, Phil, for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Martin.
If you let me have your contact details as well, I'll put them onto the Culture Pot page on Facebook, which will get shared on the Radio Sangam page as well. So thank you for listening to the show today. Have a wonderful week until next one.
Thank you, Martin.
Thank you very much. Take care.